Hello, this is Ian Wolfe, producer of Diffusion Science Radio. You can now support Diffusion through the Patreon support page at patreon.com/diffusionradio. Send me a message about the supporter awards you'd like to receive, or make a donation directly with the PayPal button, or click on an Amazon affiliate link at www.diffusionradio.com.
The International Science Radio Show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we inject weird and wonderful science directly into your brain. I'm Ian Wolfe. On this edition, part one of Jim Pulfreman, Pursuing Pulsars. But first up, here's the news. Thought text. Thexting? In an open-access project, brain signals have been converted into speech, and then into text. Researchers at Albany Medical Center in New York collected electrical brain recordings, collaborating with researchers at the Cognitive Systems Lab of Karlsruhe Institute of Technology in Germany, who developed the signal processing and automatic speech recognition methods. The team stuck needles at points about a centimetre apart into selected areas of the surface of the frontal and temporal lobes in the brains of seven people being treated with surgery for epilepsy. While we have your skull open anyway, it's a very invasive procedure which was only made possible because the people were already having open skull surgery for the epilepsy. The study only used the data from six of the seven subjects, as the data from one person was unreadable. Because the probes are inside the skull, they were able to record at a much higher resolution than is currently possible from outside the skull. They recorded signals directly from neurons where speech is produced in the cortex, using intracranial electrocorticography, as people read out aloud from a sample text. Using machine learning techniques from automatic speech recognition, they were able to recognize the electrical equivalent of hearing parts of words and sounds that together could be reconstructed into speech, and then converted into text. They were able to identify the regions in the cortex that hold substantial information about individual speech sounds, called phones. The subjects read the Gettysburg Address, President Kennedy's inaugural address, a Mother Goose story, or fan fiction based on the TV series Charmed. The text was displayed on a screen about a metre away from them. The text scrolled from left to right at a rate suited to the individual reader. The audio recordings were phone-labelled using a custom speech recognition toolkit. Because the audio and brain data were recorded in synchronisation, they were able to identify the brain signals that were produced at the time of any given phones. The software was correct about the word sounds, the phones, up to 50% of the time when the segments of audio from the recorded speech had a dictionary size of 10 to 100 words. The software correctly recognized words up to 75% of the time. The team hoped to be able to replace words spoken aloud with imagined speech in a future brain-to-computer interface that works on thought alone. This kind of technology with imagined speech, also known technically as covert speech, could help people with locked-in syndrome who otherwise need an expensive magnetic resonance image machine to slowly answer questions to indicate their thoughts. Eventually, it might even replace the keyboard and touchscreen with covert speech recognition. The paper was published in the journal Frontiers in Neuroscience and was titled Brain to Text, Decoding Spoken Phrases from Phone Representations in the Brain. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Ian Wolfe on Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network and podcast over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com. And now, part one of Pursuing Pulsars. Jim Palfreyman is an astrophysicist at the University of Tasmania, three quarters through completing his PhD. He contacted me after hearing my interview with Maynard on the Skeptic Zone podcast with the latest research in pulsars. I phoned him and began by asking Jim, what is a pulsar?
So before we answer that question, what we might do is go back to the beginning of the life, of how a star begins its life. So floating around in the galaxy, if you like, or in the universe, is little bits of hydrogen, and they sort of tend to attract each other just by gravity, and they clump together. And this just takes a long time, by the way. And over time, the clumps get bigger, and because they're bigger, they have stronger gravity, so they attract more clumps of hydrogen. And the clump sort of gets bigger and bigger, and the gravity gets stronger and stronger. So eventually what happens, the gravity's getting so strong and there's enough hydrogen there that the gravity's pulling the hydrogen in, and it gets hot. And eventually it gets hot enough that a fusion reaction begins. Now, so what happens then if a fusion reaction, and that's not a fission reaction, which is what we, you know, do with atomic bombs and nuclear reactors and the like. Fission is splitting the atom. Fusion is sort of pushing it together. So you squash two hydrogen atoms into a helium atom, and then that process gives off energy. So this process begins, and your star has gravity pulling in and the fusion nuclear reaction pushing out, and it all settles down in a lovely balance, and there you have a star. So this star ticks away, you know, for a few billion years, depending on how large it was to start with, and eventually the hydrogen runs out. Now, once the hydrogen runs out, there's a few scenarios that can happen, and I'm going to look at the big picture here, but the scenarios that happen is depending on the original size of the star. So a star that is large will have a shorter lifetime, and that's sort of a little bit opposite to what you might think. You'd think that it would have more fuel, and so it would last longer. It's actually the opposite. It burns through the fuel quicker. And ultimately what happens is the hydrogen runs out, and gravity, which is eternal, it just wins the battle and crushes everything down again. And then further fusion reactions can begin. The helium can begin to fuse. Now, if the star is big enough, and I'm sort of talking, you know, five or more solar masses approximately, you'll get this massive explosion called a supernova. And at that point, a lot of heavier elements are made. And so, you know, the equipment we're sort of looking at now, our laptops and our computers and things that might be around you with metals and heavier elements, all were manufactured in supernovas like this. Anyway, a big enough star, the supernova occurs, sprays all the stuff across the galaxy, and then what's left over collapses down. Now, what happens here is that you have this thing called escape velocity, which is, like if I throw a rock in the air, it comes back down. If I can throw something fast enough, it will escape the Earth's gravitational pull and enter, or either leave the Earth or orbit it. And that's called the escape velocity. Now, this back to our star, our very large star, its escape velocity is greater than the speed of light. So what that means is light can't escape. And that's where we have a black hole. Now, you know, black holes are fascinating, but the problem is we sort of can't really see what's going on inside them, and that's a bit of a problem. So that's one option. The second option, which is the star is fairly small, like about the size of our sun, it doesn't go supernova. It's not big enough for that to happen. And so it just fades away like a fire running out of wood, you know, just crackles away to a brown dwarf or a white dwarf, and that's pretty much the end of it. Now, if it's a sort of middle-sized Goldilocks star, 3 to 5 solar masses, you will get the supernova explosion, but what's left collapses down, but it doesn't have enough gravity to stop light or electromagnetic radiation escaping. But, however, having said that, the gravity is strong enough that the electrons can be still forced into the nucleus of the atom to combine with the protons to form neutrons. And there's already neutrons in the nucleus as well, and so you get this this neutron star, as it's called. So now, this neutron star is incredibly dense. You know, we're sort of talking a teaspoonful weighs as much as a battleship, that sort of density. It's probably has a solid crust and a superfluid core, but we can see it, and that's good. Now, the other thing, there's two other things that are important here. The neutron star has a magnetic field that's incredibly strong. So just like our Earth, we've got a north and we've got a south pole. Our sun's got a magnetic field. Well, this crushes, when this star collapses down to a neutron star, the magnetic field gets very strong. And I'm talking of the order of, 10 to the 12 Gauss. And just to, what's that? Well, our Earth's magnetic field is, I think from memory, about 0.6 or 0.7 of a Gauss. So 10 to the 12 is a trillion Gauss. So it's a very, very strong magnetic field. Now, that magnetic field is so strong, the way I like to describe it, it's sort of so strong that it can sort of keep any electromagnetic radiation, like radio waves, it can sort of suck those back onto it and they can't escape. But at the north and south pole, they can escape the radio waves that are being emitted. Now, one other thing we have is that the original star would have been rotating, just like our sun does. Our sun rotates once a month. Most people don't know that, but it does. Now, when this star collapses, it's collapsing from a 3 to 5 solar masses, a large star, down to about 20 kilometres across. And just like an ice skater who would pull her arms in while spinning, she'll get faster. The star does too as it spins. And pulsars can spin, the one I'm observing mostly, it spins 11 times a second. Now, if one of those magnetic poles that I talked about happens to sweep past the Earth, we will see a flash in radio waves. And basically, that's called a pulsar. So if the pole wasn't pointing at the Earth, it would still be a spinning neutron star. Technically, it's a pulsar for another observer somewhere, but we wouldn't see it as a pulsar. So there's many neutron stars out there. Not all of them are pulsars.
So sort of like a lighthouse, you have to be in the path of the beam for you to see it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. A lighthouse is a good analogy, and we study, pulsar astrophysicists, we study these pulses very, very in depth. I mean, it's a very extreme environment out there, and there's a lot to learn, and so what we do is we study these pulses. Now, some of these pulsars spin very fast. The fastest we know of is up around the 750 times per second.
Hmm.
The slowest is, I think from memory, about once every 8 seconds. So the Vela pulsar, 11 times a second, that's, round helicopter blades to give you an idea of how fast that is. And we study these pulses and use atomic clocks as references because they're very accurate. These pulsars can be very accurate in their spin rates. And especially the faster ones, the millisecond pulsars as they're called, they spin around 700 times a second or so, but they spin with an accuracy that actually rivals or is potentially even better than most atomic clocks. So they have their own interests and uses as well. The search for gravitational waves has been happening, hopefully using millisecond pulsars, but that method was beaten a few weeks ago, as you probably know.
Mm. So how long do they spin for?
Many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years. So they spin. And remember, it's a magnetic field spinning. It's in an environment, so it is slowing down. So yes, they do slow down. And we can look at their speed and how fast they're spinning. So the ones that are spinning slowly have slowed down and are old, and the faster ones tend to be younger ones. So the Vela pulsar is 11 times a second. That's a fairly young pulsar. It's only 10,000 years old. But some of the older ones would be millions of years old.
And do we actually use them as clocks or as navigational things to find our way around the sky?
No, we don't. Having said that, though, there was a fairly famous plaque put on one of the spaceships that we sent. I can't remember which one now.
Voyager?
That we sent out. I think it might have been Voyager. Anyway, Carl Sagan and a bunch of others designed the design that went on there. And on that design, you can see this sort of, it looks like this ball with spokes coming out of it. And each one of those spokes is actually a direction to a pulsar. And they've encoded the periods of the pulsar in a code that the aliens should be able to decode and work out how fast that pulsar is spinning, and that can be used as a navigational aid to find where Earth is. So, to answer your question, I suppose we have, but I mean, we don't use it for everyday navigation.
Because we're not travelling among the stars just yet.
No, that's right. It could be used as a method. The problem is, though, if you get out of the beam, you can't see the pulsar, so that's a problem. And they're also fairly faint, too, typically. Like, you would need a radio dish of about 10 metres across to start to see a pulsar. And the Vela pulsar, which I study, is the brightest pulsar in the sky. And so the rest of them, they drop away pretty quickly after that. They're fairly faint.
So you're studying the brightest pulsar. How long has it been known about?
The exact date I think it was discovered was around 1968. And it was discovered in Australia and at Molonglo Observatory, I believe. So it's been known for a long time. It's a very southern object, so it can not be seen very well in the northern hemisphere, or only for a very brief time if the telescope can go low to their horizon. So we have the advantage in the southern hemisphere that we get a very good view. And from where I am in Hobart, we can observe the Vela pulsar for 19 hours a day.
Was it the first one discovered since it's the brightest?
No, actually it wasn't. The first pulsar that was discovered is the innocuous name of CP1919, although we give it a different name now. But no, it was discovered by Jocelyn Bell Burnell, or Jocelyn Bell at the time. She's Jocelyn Bell Burnell now. And it's a faintish one, but it's in the northern sky because they discovered it in the northern sky. They couldn't see the Vela pulsar, so they wouldn't have come across it. But once pulsars were discovered, the southern observatories got into gear fairly quickly and started looking, and the Vela pulsar was found fairly soon after.
And what have you discovered about the Vela pulsar?
Okay, so I've been studying this particular pulsar for about 8 years now. I did a master's first part-time while I was working, and then I found myself out of a job, as in I was retrenched, and so I enrolled as a PhD and continued my studies. And what I found a few things. So these pulses that we get from our lighthouse, as you described it, they vary in brightness. And one of the first things I found when I was doing my master's and published a paper back then on that was that the brightness varies. So sometimes you get bright pulses, some brighter than others. And I found that the brighter ones tended to come together, you know, sort of grouped together. If it was a random process, that it was just, you know, some probability, like typically the probability around then when I was observing was about 1 in 180, I think, from memory, that the bright pulses would occur. So for, let's call it 1 in 200 to make it easy, that means for two to occur in a row, two bright pulses, you know, let's say a bright pulse occurs, then for the next bright pulse, the next pulse after it to be bright would be one chance in 180. To get three in a row would be one chance in 40,000, and then so on as you went up. And the numbers got very huge very quickly. So you would be lucky technically to see three in a row, even four in a row. That would be just never happen. I found six in a row, and that the probability of that happening was just not on. So what that says was that they're not independent events, these flashes. They are linked somehow. So the mechanism causes the radio emission sort of is a bit long-lived. The emission mechanism of pulsars, even after all this time, is actually, to be honest, really not very well understood. There's a few competing arguments and so on. So we don't really fully know why and how it happens. And that's part of what I'm researching. So that was back then. What I've been doing now is I have access to a very large data store. And one of the advantages we've got here down here in Tasmania is the telescope I use now is a 26-metre telescope at Mount Pleasant. It's not a big telescope. You know, the Parkes dish, which everyone knows about, the dish is 64 metres across. And then there's dishes, you know, hundreds of metres across around the world. Pretty hard to get time on those. And if you get time, you might get your 4 hours on that after you put in a proposal and take that data and go away and write your paper. We have the advantage here at the University of Tasmania that we've got a medium-sized dish, which is, you know, very nice, but we've got time on it. We've time to dedicate. So what I've been doing is observing for the last 2 years. I've been observing this pulsar at 19 hours a day. And that's collecting at a data rate, by the way, of 640 megabytes every 10 seconds. And that adds up being about 4 terabytes of data every day.
So that's a lot.
I've collected into the petabytes now. I have 96 cores processing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, reducing that data down to something manageable. So what did I find? A paper I got into the Astrophysical Journal was officially published a few weeks back now. And what I'd found was a couple of interesting things. One was if I took the day's worth of pulses, and each individual pulse, you know, they sort of vary around a bit. It's like looking at an object through clouds, you know, the sort of the object changes as stuff gets in the way, and there's the stuff that gets in the way between you and the pulsar pulse, the stuff in the interstellar space, but more importantly is the stuff around the pulsar, the magnetosphere and so on. And so individual pulses vary. But if you take those individual pulses and average them over time, you get a sort of what's called a pulse profile, a pulse shape that's very very steady. So what I did was, for each day of observation, each 19 hours of observation, I created a pulse profile of, and it was of the order of, I think, 750,000 pulses. And it was, you know, very steady, very identical from day to day, week to week, month to month, year to year. I thought, well, as you do when you've got these vast amounts of data, you start poking and prodding and you start looking things. You think, well, what could I plot? What graphs could I plot to try and find patterns? And what I did was I measured the width of these pulses at the 50% level. So, you know, go halfway up this pulse and the pulse itself, the pulse profile looks sort of like a human heartbeat. Actually, it's got a main pulse and then sort of a sort of little ledge on the way down. And so I looked at the halfway mark, the width of the pulse, and I measured that in milliseconds. And I plotted the change in that over time. Now, what you'd expect, what I expected to see was, you know, something, some random, you know, the widths changing randomly just due to a bit of noise or error, but no patterns in them at all. And what I found was actually quite intriguing, and it's in the published paper, that the graph of it. So to try and describe it, it was wobbling all over the place, and it looked like it had some periodic nature in it, some sort of periodicities in that data. Just when you looked at it, there's cycles going on in there, which that's always interesting, because when you get cycles, that means something's moving in a circle somehow, and that's interesting. So I did a process on it called a, for the technically minded, a Lomb-Skagel periodogram. And what that does is looks at your data and tries to find periodicities in it for you, and it's pretty good. And it pulled out three periodicities in it, three cycles. Again, I don't have the paper in front of me, which is a bit silly, but it's of the order of 70 days. I think there's another one at 120 and another one in there. I can't remember the three off the top of my head, but they're fairly distinct. Now, we'd always watch out for multiples of 24 hours and 365 days, because that could be periodicities caused by stuff at our end. But the beauty of it was it lined up, those periodicities lined up with the same numbers within the error bars anyway, of what the Chandra X-ray satellite had done. Now what that is, and this is actually available on YouTube, they observed the Vela pulsar in X-rays, and it was a satellite orbiting the Earth, because you can't observe X-rays on the ground. And they sort of observed the Vela pulsar, you know, a number of times over a 5-6 month period, and made a sort of a little video. It's not many frames on it. There's probably only 10 frames or something, but you watch it as a cycle. And as I say, that's on YouTube. And you can see it moving and rotating. And what you've got is this jet coming out. And it's a spiral. It's a corkscrew spiral. And that corkscrew spiral had three periodicities in it. And those lined up with the ones I had found in the changing of the pulse profile width. So what this means is that the Vela pulsar is most probably what's called precessing. Now, when things orbit, we get this thing called precession, and the Earth has it too. So what that means, precessing, is so at the moment the rotational axis of the Earth points to a spot in the sky, and as the Earth spins, that rotational axis also moves in a very large circle. Now, imagine spinning a top on a hard surface. Now, the top's spinning, but the rotational axis will also spin as well in this larger, slower circle. That's called precession. And you can also have little wobbles in there. So imagine this top spinning. Imagine it wobbling as it goes. Well, that's what the pulsar is doing. It's wobbling. The Chandra people picked up these wobbles in their observations, and they suggested some, you know, would be great to see if we could follow this up with radio observations. But you won't. You need nearly. I found you need around 13 plus hours per day observations on a telescope this size to be able to measure pulse profile width with that much accuracy. That was really nice, lovely confirming someone else's results.
That was Jim Palfreyman, astrophysicist from the University of Tasmania, talking about pulsars. Listen next week for more about Paul Freeman's pulsar pursuits. X-ray telescope video of the Vela pulsar will be embedded on the diffusionradio.com episode page for this show. And a big thank you to Joanna from Sydney for her annual donation. And that's all from us this week on Diffusion. Would you like to join us? We need more people contributing stories to Diffusion. You can send your contributions, opinions, congratulations, standing ovations, helpful suggestions and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. And please do send me an email so I know you're listening and would like to hear more episodes. Please like the Diffusion Science Radio page on Facebook and rate us on iTunes. Tell your friends. Follow me on Twitter @IanWolf. Check out the Patreon page at patreon.com/diffusionradio and write to me to say what sort of supporter awards you'd like to see. Checking production was Charles Willock. I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia on the Community Radio Network, including 8CCC in Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, 2NVR in Nambucca Valley, and 3MBR in the Mallee border districts of Victoria and South Australia. Diffusion is syndicated globally on the National Science Foundation's Science 360 internet radio station and also on astronomy.fm. Subscribe to the podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com, and do check the website for links, photos and videos from this week's show. If you enjoyed the show, then you can explore more than 700 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labelled by keywords so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Subscribe to the Diffusion YouTube channel at youtube.com/c/diffusionradio. I'm Ian Wolf. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the Earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography, collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.